I print this next week, and I'll be right under events.
The House Interim Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water will come to order. Committee members, we have a packed agenda today, so we will do our best to work through a number of different issues. One of the fun parts about this committee is our opportunity to hear a number of different issues and across a wide range of subjects. And it is my pleasure, with Co-Chair Gilliam, to welcome to our committee someone who brings a broad breadth of expertise in many of those subjects to this committee, and someone who I'm very excited to welcome to the House and to the House Energy, Environment, and Water Committee. That's Representative Kenny Geyer. Representative, welcome. And
thank you.
Care to introduce yourself briefly?
Hi, I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer. I'm representing House District 46, which covers parts of southeast and northeast Portland, and I was appointed by the Multnomah County Commission to fill the vacancy left by Ben Cannon when he became the education advisor to the governor, and I'm really pleased to be a part of this committee. I actually go back a long way with Vic Gilliam, back to when we first moved to Portland in 1994, so look forward to working with all the members of this committee.
Fantastic. Well, welcome. Thank you. And so I guess that's two people on this committee now that have had to step into a role previously held by Representative Cannon. So
right,
it casts
right.
A long shadow over this committee, not just because of his height.
Big shoes to fill.
Yeah, so they say. So we're going to go ahead and get started with the informational meeting today. And we're going to start with a work group update on House Bills 2873 and 3613. I believe we have Brett Brownscombe here today to kick us off. So do I actually need to open the informational? Okay. Not try to drive this train with the training wheels on in the interim. So I'm going to open an informational meeting on House Bill 2873 and House Bill 3613 work group updates and call for Brett Brownscombe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Brett Brownscombe. For the record, I work for the governor's office as one of his two natural resource policy advisors, and I'm here today to update you on two work groups. Fresh off the road from the Association of Morgan Counties conference in Eugene, so excuse the. I'll pull it together. Fine.
All in the same boat.
Thanks. So the first committee work group rather is related to House Bill 2873. And so this work group arose out of concerns over inline conduit hydropower development. And so this is hydropower developed within irrigation districts to generate power that can offset revenues or can offset costs and generate revenues for irrigation districts. And the concerns arose out of implementation of inline conduit projects running up against ODFW, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's implementation of its fish passage obligations. And so where we are with the group, we've met once. The second meeting is set for December, or soon to be set for December. The work group includes members of the irrigation district community, Oregon Water Congress, and then members of the conservation community. Beth Petrino, thank you for your help in working through this work group. What I can tell you as a committee is where we are as the governor's office is trying to work through the concerns over inline conduit hydro development without the need for future legislation, and the desire is to move through this work group and come to some solutions around meeting the interests of both inline conduit hydro development for the reasons that I mentioned, that it can be a winner for, I think, important agriculture-related cost-cutting and revenue generation, and it's also consistent with, it can be certainly consistent with a green way to generate energy. The desire is to achieve a solution that advances those interests while still advancing the state's fish passage laws and objectives. We feel like there are ways to do this. There are some obstacles to generation of or advancing hydropower projects within irrigation districts that relate to ODFW's implementation of their fish passage program, as well as outreach with irrigation districts around how the program works and where passage barriers are and what are the priorities There are also obstacles that I think ideally this work group is going to address around financial issues and the costs of doing inline or resolving fish passage barriers, which to remove a barrier can be significantly expensive and can have a chilling effect on an irrigation district's ability to do that while also advancing an inline conduit project. So that's that work group. I'll move on to House Bill 3613, and then if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them. House Bill 3613 was motivated by concerns that new water quality standards adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission and administered by the Department of Environmental Quality would result in requirements for farmers and ranchers that would be impossible to meet, and that would in turn be standards that would in turn be used to try and shut down particular operations. And Representative Bentz, I know, knows the issue and the bill well. The bill and the overall effort around this work group relates to the roles of the state's departments of environmental quality and agriculture around non-point source pollution issues. And 3613 working group has talked through how Oregon's water quality standards are being implemented, and they've done this in some detail, and the group is providing Oregon Department of Agriculture and DEQ with input on development of a new memorandum of agreement between the agencies on how the non-point source program is administered. There appears to be a high level of agreement amongst the work group members, which has been encouraging. The work group includes members, staff, and representatives from the Cattlemen's Association, from the Farm Bureau, from Oregon Environmental Council, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, as well as other interests, and is staffed by the directors of Department of Ag, Environmental Quality, and their staff, as well as the Department of Justice. So for good reasons, the work group is a high priority. The governor's made it clear that he will not support legislation that weakens the state's water quality standards, nor that weakens the state's agricultural water quality program. The desire is to keep the Department of Agriculture in the lead when it comes to non-point source issues. He's willing, and the group is continuing to explore whether state statutes can be amended to clarify how the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Environmental Quality work together in this area. And the group has also identified the importance of having scientific data to show overall program effectiveness in the non-point source arena. This relates to the good work that private landowners are doing to implement projects to address water quality issues. We know they're ongoing. The issue is not whether they're happening, but whether there is monitoring data to indicate whether the overall program is effective in addressing water quality standards. So I think of relevance to you and the committee, the recent funding package from last session for OD, Oregon Department of Agriculture, to improve its ability to evaluate the effectiveness of the Ag Water Quality Program is essential in addressing these program effectiveness monitoring issues. And to conclude, the group has met twice, positive meetings both times. We have one more meeting scheduled where the focus will be whether consensus can finally be reached. There has been a good bit already, but this is more of, I think, one last meeting to try to wrap it up. On agreement around the memorandum of agreement, as well as the need for legislative clarifications if they exist beyond the memorandum of agreement. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you for that report. I imagine there are folks at home that love hearing the phrase, the agreement on the memorandum of agreement. This is government, isn't it? Representative Bentz, you've been very close to this issue. Did you want to comment on any of this from the dais or from the podium?
Thank you. From here is fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Just a couple of remarks. First, I want to thank the governor's office for working with me so carefully and so diligently to try to address this issue. It's a classic case of establishing a standard that's impossible to meet and then running around wildly trying to figure out how to meet it. And so I think the Environmental Quality Commission understood this back in 2008 when they said in their minutes that mishandled these new standards could be economically devastating. And I know the governor recognizes that and recognizes that if we don't treat with great care these impossible to meet standards, we can put a whole bunch of people out of business. And and that wouldn't just be farmers, ranchers, and loggers. It would be people in cities wondering how in the world they're going to pay much higher bills for sewage disposal. And so it was no wonder that the cities came rushing in after we worked so hard to put together an agreement, which we had, and said, gosh, this is terrible. These people appear to be not being held to the same egregious standards that we are. And we want to head this bill off. Unfortunately, they are confused over how different the standards are when it comes to non-point point source pollution, but they're desperate, so who can blame them? But I do appreciate, truly, the governor's efforts and understand that if we don't manage this exactly right, we're going to really, really hurt ourselves. And in that regard, I need to ask if the governor, or if you, if it has a plan for how... it's going to manage the cities, because indeed the city situation is grim given these new higher standards. And 3613 is addressed toward non-point source issues. And if I were in the governor's shoes, and I'm glad I'm not in this respect, I'd be terrifically worried about how in the world the cities are going to meet these new higher standards. So I ask, it's one thing to talk about the MOU between the Department of Ag and DEQ, which I just want to remind everybody that, of course, the Clean Water Act says that there's no enforceability, really, when it comes to non-point source polluters or pollutants, but there most assuredly is when it comes to point sources. So I just would ask, is there a similar work group working for the cities on variance prospects to try to incrementally achieve these impossible-to-meet standards?
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you. Thanks for the acknowledgement of the work on the committee. And to answer the question, there's not a specific effort identified as of yet. I know there are concerns amongst the point source community over how the new standards will be implemented. Two things I would mention, and without going into too much detail and taking up too much time for the committee, the Clean Water Act obviously has an approach for point sources and an approach for non-point sources. What the work group on 3613 has done that I think is worth noting and helpful is talk not just about the roles of the departments in implementing the standards once they're adopted, but the roles of the departments in working with the agricultural community in the formulation of the standards up front. And so this relates to the total maximum daily loads that are put in place, and then the implementation of those standard of those waste load allocations through the TMDLs. It's something where I think those around the table have acknowledged that there's benefit to engaging more up front with the agricultural community around the establishment of the standards, not just on the tail end of how are you going to meet the standards. With respect to the point sources, there's obviously a need to address that as well. Some of the areas that we've been considering include ecosystem service markets and the possibility for cities to address waste load allocations, not simply through investing many, many millions in hard technology to build chillers if it's temperature or other treatment facilities, but to instead address or invest money in, probably at a lower level, so at a cost savings, in habitat upstream. And so to try to build bridges between cities and landowners upstream of cities who can implement habitat restoration work that would address the water quality issues that the cities have to meet through the standards. So it's a new area. It's a growing area of work where the City of Ashland and Medford have been working on this with folks in the nonprofit community, the one basin where it has been implemented is in the Tualatin through Clean Water Services, and I'll leave it at that. But there is a need. I agree on how to implement new standards through the point source area as well, and we'll deal with that as it arises.
Thank you again for your indulgence. I would just say I'm going to say one lawsuit away, and for all I know, the lawsuit's been filed based on the failure to implement these new standards. And so the luxury of time may not be available. So once having established these, and we have, through the EQC's adoption of these new standards, I just wonder if there shouldn't be more concern about how the cities are going to meet them. I wonder, because the standards are now in place, and the only way to avoid them is through these other tools, such as variances. So I'm just saying that's all very good to talk about going upstream, but that takes lots and lots and lots of time. And so there's only a few very narrow types of tools available to avoid the lawsuits that will force the cities to comply with these standards. Lawsuits in other areas may occur, may not. Standards may not be as enforceable. But what I'm trying to say here is we've created, I hate to say we, there has been created a set of standards that could be a very dangerous tool if not thought about in advance. That was the reason for 3613, so that we could continue a really good program, the 1010 program, and make sure it continued to do the good things it is without being forced to do so with a lawsuit. So I'm absolutely positive the governor's aware of this. I'm just saying I think we need to raise the level of concern in these work groups.
Co-Chair Bailey and Representative Benz, thank you. This did arise last session, and so I had some experience with it early on, and I know there is, we're expecting a report back from the Department of Environmental Quality on what it's done on the variance front. The idea of addressing the standards, which in this case came from, it's a toxicity level standard. I was just yesterday at the government-to-government summit with the tribal governments, who, due to their fish consumption rates, are very keen on this standard being in place to protect them against toxicity levels from fish consumption.
That's a good question.
For the cities, I'm also very aware that there may be background levels on toxics that are what they are and justify a variance. And so we've, at the end of last session, the expectation was the Department of Environmental Quality was going to go back, look at the variance issue, work with cities, and not just cities, but the point source community as a whole on the variance issue. And so I don't have a report for the committee on that at this point. Once I do check in with DEQ on where they are on the variance issue, I'm happy to come back and report on it.
Thank you.
We appreciate your update on 3613. It's a bill with which this committee still, although we have folks on this committee who are very familiar with this bill, as you know, it did not come through this committee in the regular session, and so I think we're all still finding our way on that. However, 2873 did come through this committee and passed out of this committee. I'd like to return to that topic for just a moment at the risk of running too far behind. A lot of the debate in this committee revolved around, I think it's fair to say, a desire to move forward very quickly on these projects, which are good for economic development and good for clean, renewable energy, while at the same time, as you indicated, this tension here of finding perhaps another way of leveraging the fish screens that need to go in, and that this had become a proxy perhaps for the program in order to get fish screens on these diversion projects. And so I want to hear that the work group is addressing very specifically perhaps other ways in which we might fund and incent and roll out fish screen programs that aren't necessarily reliant on holding up clean energy projects.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee, there's been no
no dispute amongst folks on the work group, including especially the irrigation district community, over the need to screen. And where the work group is focused is on canals that have already been screened. Why not implement micro hydro projects? And the issue has been more around dealing with actual barriers and the removal of barriers that may have existed for a long time. And so the committee is focused on, the work group is focused on looking at the alternative funding sources, because the concern is if a district has to deal with a barrier right now just to do a hydro project on a canal that's already been screened, the existence of the cost to remove that barrier can sink the hydropower project. And so I think there is a need for creative approaches to financing the removal of barriers, as well as a need to for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to really prioritize what barriers are critical. There's an obligation to update their fish passage barrier priority list, which they're working on. And so we are doing that. We are working on the financing approach to try to deal with that obstacle to inline hydro conduit development.
Excellent. Other questions on this? Well, we appreciate the update, and I want to echo Representative Bence's comment. I know I can speak for Co-Chair Gilliam on this as well, although he'll tell me if I can't, to say thank you to the governor and to you and to his staff for spending your time and your resources on facilitating these work groups and trying to assess the legislative process. So thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. With that, we'll close the informational meeting on the work group updates on House Bills 2873 and 3613, and open an informational meeting on siting solar facilities and exclusive farm use lands. Call forward Michael Morrissey to give us an update, and John Jennings.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey and committee members. I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With me is John Jennings, who's a community services specialist. I'm housed in Salem. He's housed in Bend. Together, we staffed a rules advisory committee that helped formulate recommendations for the siting of solar photovoltaic siting facilities. That has been going on since late 2010. So I'm going to give about 1 minute's worth of the process of how we got here, and John's going to give you an overview of what the rules really say. I sent along some material in advance. I don't know if you had a chance to look at them. They were a second staff report on the rules, and then the rules themselves. In summer of 2010, LCDC was approached by Jefferson County and some other groups, including solar developers, who've been meeting with the county to take up the issue of siting of these facilities on farmland, EFU zone lands. Their interest was particularly in central and eastern Oregon, where there's a lot of rangelands, which was where some of these companies were looking to site some of their larger facilities potentially. Some felt that the rules were too restrictive on farmland for siting these types of facilities. The commission had gone through a similar exercise a couple years before that for wind facilities. So the commission put it on its work plan, and in the fall of 2010 established a rules advisory committee with a lot of different interests, including farm interests, environmental interests, and solar interests, and some counties and geographical interests. And that committee met from roughly September through February of 2011, and then took a pause while some legislation, House Bill 3595, was being considered by the legislature. Ultimately, that was not successful, and the commission and the Rules Advisory Committee went ahead and finished its work, so that in June of 2011, some recommendations for these rules were taken to the commission there was quite a bit of testimony, and the commission asked staff to do some more work, which it did. There was one more meeting of the Rules Advisory Committee, and then in October of this year, the recommendations went forward to LCDC, and they adopted the rules that John's going to give you the oversight on. So at this point, the commission has adopted the rules, and we're ready to file them with the Secretary of State.
Thank you, Michael, and Co-Chair Bailey and Co-Chair Gilliam. I'm John Jennings, for the record. As Michael said, I'm the Community Services Specialist. I operate out of Bend, Oregon, and our Bend Eastern Oregon Field Office. I'd like to just spend a few minutes and not take up too much time at all, but to talk about sort of how we got started, with which Michael alluded to, and then what we learned and heard through that process and then where we ended up. The interest in renewable energy and siting those on rural lands really seemed to heat up in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it was all about wind. We addressed that issue, and then here recently, in the last 36 months or so, there seemed to be a dramatic interest, maybe cooled down a little bit, but a dramatic interest in solar as well. And we were asked, we the department and ultimately the commissioner, asked to engage in rulemaking, which we did. And it's customary that we put together an advisory committee. And I wrote the wind rule, so I have a pretty good recollection of what happened there. And our advisory committee, as Michael said, included a lot of different people. And it was clear to me right out of the gate that this was going to be a different process or different rulemaking. It was different in that there doesn't seem to have been the honeymoon period for solar in the manner that there was for wind. And there's some very different opinions that were expressed strongly and passionately by different people. So we were working to reconcile all those things. You know, we were reconciling what we heard from our ag representatives about protection of high-value farmland and trying to limit consequences for the environmental community, who lobbied us very hard to include environmental issues as consideration. And then, of course, the solar industry themselves. And the one thing I would say that among the disagreements, everyone on that committee agreed that there was a place for solar on our rural lands and our agricultural lands. And so, again, this is what we would call Goal 3 or Division 33 rulemaking. Those are lands protected under exclusive farm use, and by statute and by the Commission's rules, farm uses and farm-related uses are given the highest priority. It's not to say that other uses can't go out there. They obviously do, or that they're disparaged against or second-class citizens. It's just that farm uses are given the highest priority. If we wanted to reverse that and give another use a higher status, there's a possibility to do that. It's the exceptions process. And you justify that there are reasons that it just makes sense to allow something that wouldn't ordinarily be allowed. What we're talking about, though, is being able to allow commercial photovoltaic solar with a fairly straightforward and fairly simple conditional use process. They go to the county, they go to a planning commission, they get their approval, as opposed to the more elaborate exceptions process. And that process was used very successfully by the wind industry and by others. But again, it's a little more complex. So that's what we're trying to do. And through that, we learned a number of things that were very helpful. I've had a really good time, worked with a lot of good people. And we learned that solar is pretty land consumptive, you know, about 7.5 acres per megawatt. By comparison, wind, I think, is probably less than an acre, in a much different distributed fashion. The baseline plants, a natural gas plant or something, probably can, well, for instance, I think the Hermiston Power Plant is generating 500 plus megawatts on about 20 acres. But they don't use any water. They don't produce any noise. Obviously, they harvest the sun, which is a great thing. And there's a potential for substantial tax revenues, which is a huge benefit, especially for Oregon's rural counties. So we're trying to get all this together. We went through several drafts, and it would have been a lot easier if we were just working with the solar industry. But we had to account for these other parties. That's a natural way to do it. So we ended up with retaining some thresholds in the rule for high-value farmland, the state's best farmland. Another category, which we've called arable lands, which is land that isn't quite high-value but is still cultivated. It's put to cultivated agriculture. And then we've called non-arable. which are really this really range lands or the dry lands that can't be cultivated. They're used for livestock grazing, mostly, or maybe even nothing at all. Quite frankly. And so we wanted to put the crosshair squarely on those lands. We wrote the rule with the intention of giving an incentive, a reward through a more easy siting process to solar developers who selected to their prospecting areas that had the least importance for agriculture and the lowest value for wildlife. So that's what we attempted to do. Our wildlife provisions, again, we had a lot of interest in making sure that wildlife were taken into consideration, but this wasn't a wildlife rule. This was a farm rule, so we did the best that we could. We tried to roll in what we understood to be the best management practices, what a good, responsible solar developer would do anyway, and we also put a sunset on it. And the reason for that was that this was to be viewed as a grace period or perhaps a bridge from today, where most counties' inventories of wildlife habitat are frankly outdated, to some point in the future where hopefully they're in better shape. So until that time, you know, we have something intact. We again, spent a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of good people thought really hard about it. We didn't gain consensus in the end. You're going to hear, I think, some folks that have some disagreements, and that's fine. I'll go on to say I think that everybody had some disagreements with the way things turned out. I know the agricultural folks had some strong feelings about certain things that did not get addressed, did not get put in the rule. And I know that the wildlife community is very disappointed that the wildlife provisions will sunset. So again, we did our best we could. We tried to respond to everyone's concerns, and I think that's where we ended up. That's what the commission felt. They adopted the rule on October 6th in Grants Pass, Oregon, and you know, we'll see how it goes. I'm anxious to see how this actually gets carried out on the ground. With that, I think I'm done. Looks like Michael has something to say, and I'll try to answer any questions.
So you may already know this. Co-Chair Bailey and committee members, the gist of what's going on here is we were asked to make the rules easier for siting of solar facilities, especially on rangeland. And there's what's called the 1220 rule. Facilities can be sited on up to 12 acres of high-value farmland, 20 acres of non-high-value. Right now, today, that's the way the rules were. The result of the rulemaking that we did made it somewhat easier, although I think some folks will have some disagreements about the wildlife part, but somewhat easier to go up to 100 acres now instead of just 20 through a conditional use permit. And we also took out some provisions after the first presentation to the commission, some provisions that were in there about certain types of analysis that had to be done on high-value farmland and on arable lands, and those were called EC analysis, and we removed those. And I think there was some appreciation from the solar folks about doing that.
If I could add one more thing, co-chairs. I would just say that we did have an initial evidentiary hearing before LCDC on June 22nd, I think, of last year, this year. That was very instructive for us. And we came away from that meeting, that first meeting, with some direction from the commission, direction from the governor's office, and also some good ideas from folks that had testified. And as Michael mentioned, resulting from that first meeting, we relaxed some of the standards that were in there. We made it very clear this only applied to commercial projects. Feed-in tariff projects or net metering projects are not subject to this rule. And again, I think it improved things. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it works on the ground.
So I think that's probably the gist of it. If you have any questions, we're glad to answer them.
Questions for this panel? Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here and for your report. I'm sorry, John, that you had to go through this in the way that you did. It might have been better to get solar siding done before you authored the honeymoon of wind. But you're now probably prepared to run for office out there.
I don't know about that.
What's our next step? Do you feel like we're done? Do you feel like we've got, I mean, I know you guys have a different role in terms of all the stakeholders, and yet you heard them all. I'm just wondering, and Mr. Chair, I look forward to the other testimony, so I don't want to spend too much time here, but I'm wondering what your reaction would be.
Mr. Chair, Chair Gilliam, what I would say, no, I don't think we are done. I think that the feeling of most of the groups, not all of them, and I know the feeling from the co-chairs, which were members of LCDC, was that this is a starting point. And we're gonna start here, and as we learn more, you know, one of the things that we were at a disadvantage of is when we wrote the wind rule, first thing we did is went out to a wind project and looked at it, and drove around on it, and talked to the managers and the guys working out there. We didn't have that to assist us with solar. So I think that there's by no means the sense that we're finished. I think the sense is that we're beginning, and as we start to see these on the ground and understand better how we operate, we may very well look at it again, look at it a little differently.
Quick follow-up to that, if I might, Mr. Chair. I would say I appreciate that, and I'm glad you have that kind of attitude about we're not done, because for me, I know it's complicated. I know we've got to cover all the bases and all the interests in Oregon. But to your point, even though you couldn't go drive around a site that's already up, it's very important that industry says this works, that we are big enough and we are generating enough harvesting of the sun that this works. We may have all of our ducks in a row, but if we're not producing something that they're interested in sustaining, then we're in trouble.
You don't have to comment on that.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the 100 acres, why the 100 acres? Why not 500 acres? Why not
50 acres? That's a good question, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz. And so the 100 acres, being a rural guy, I would have rather gone to 80 or 160. That seemed a better fit to me. But we went with 100 acres because we, at one of the very beginning meeting sessions, we had heard from industry that they believed that there should be a chance to site a 10 megawatt project or 100 acre project, however that was measured, on farmland through a conditional use permit. Now, again, bear in mind, you can have a 500 acre project or a 1,000 acre project if you go through the exceptions process. It's a little more elaborate, but it's available. This is just for the more simple, straightforward one. So 100 acres seemed to resonate with people, and then also when we came to realize that matched the provision in statute, which we understand, and there may be some disagreement about this, but we understand, and the industry folks who worked with understood, and their lawyers understood, that at 100 acres is the trigger that a project would go and be reviewed by the Energy Facility Siting Council. And so what we did, and the RACs agreed, that was, I think, an area that they generally agreed on, was that it made sense for local government to review those projects below 100 acres, but since the trigger was in statute already, those above 100 acres would go be reviewed by the Energy Facility Siting Council. So, Michael has something to add.
So, Co-Chair Bailey and Representative Benz, we did have a member of the Energy Department on our Rules Advisory Committee, and that person made a presentation to the committee and affirmed there that 100 acres was the threshold that's in the energy statutes. And so the committee worked under the assumption for the whole period of time that what we were talking about was the current rules that had some limitations at 12 and 20 acres, and that we were going to, or the Rules Advisory Committee was going to see what it could do to relax those rules up to 100 acres. We've had some discussions with some of the staff at the Department of Energy, and I still believe that is the effective threshold that's established in the energy statutes for when something gets handed off at a certain size, and it relates to not the acreage exactly, but I believe it's actually a transformation of numbers from the megawatts that are produced by that facility.
Hold up, Mr. Chair.
Well,
I guess this is a classic. I understand the underlying rationale, and it sounds like a good one, the crossover into the lot of energy issues or FSEC issues or siting issues. But in my part of the world, 100 acres isn't much. And it's unfortunate we have this one-size-fits-all mentality, which I know it doesn't. That's not how you guys just explained it, and I appreciate that. But 1,000 acres would be more exciting in my part of the world. 100 acres over here, it's a lot. Over there, it's not. And so I'm just saying, I understand the challenges you guys face. I would hope the next time around, you might look at different areas a little differently and say, hey, you know, where there's nothing but space, which I hate point out that my district is 30,000 square miles. I have no idea how many millions of acres. But we would love to see a couple of much larger than 100-acre projects over there, taking up a few of my 30,000 square miles.
So I hope this is not what Co-Chair Reflect is anyway, trying to contradict anything. That you've said, it's those are the parameters we felt we were given to work with. I totally agree with you, but what I was going to say and sort of blanked out there for a minute. The solar industry reflected to us in the beginning of the Rules Advisory Committee that, and I feel like this is still true to a large degree because I don't think there are very many facilities built, except for a few small ones perhaps here in the Valley, that they're really at the front end of trying to get a toehold, make things work financially, build facilities. And as John said, I think if we had more information and they have more information, we'll find out how this works out. At this point in time, we've got the FSEC rules, we've got agricultural rules. The committee did its best and the commission did its best to make life a little easier. And as we all get a track record of getting these things going, maybe that'll be time to reconsider, especially for sites that are not in the Willamette Valley.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Call up David Brown, Glenn Montgomery, and John Audley. Gentlemen, I'll let you go in whichever order you want. I would like to do our best to try to get the hearing back on schedule a little bit, so if you can be as concise as possible, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
You want me to take it off? I'm happy to. Sure. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, the nonprofit trade group that represents the solar industry in Oregon. I haven't been as intimately involved in the rulemaking process as some of my colleagues, the two that are to my right. I won't speak to a lot of the detail that's gone on in that rulemaking process. However, a couple of conclusions that I've drawn. I think there have been improvements made in the current rules compared to previous drafts. John had mentioned a couple of those in terms of excluding small-scale projects, net metering and FIT projects, removing the EC analysis. I think those were positive changes. Ultimately, I think we've still missed the mark in terms of looking back at the legislation that was introduced in last session. I don't think we're quite meeting the spirit of that legislation. I don't think we have created a process that promotes renewable energy development in rural lands where it would make sense to do so, and that we've created a streamlined process in which to make that happen. And so, you know, as I pondered what I might say here, one of the thoughts that I had was, you know, stepping back from this, I think we've been so enmeshed in the details, sometimes it helps to stick our head up and look around and gain some perspective. And so I was trying to think of the bigger picture and what we're trying to achieve. And for me, I would use the analogy of our short-term economic pain that we're currently struggling through. You know, we are trying to get ourselves out of a slump, and that pain is very acute. But it pales in comparison to what we may be dealing with in large-scale issues when we start talking about climate change. The planet is warming. I think that debate has been put to bed, and those of us who are sitting here in this room would agree that the planet has been warming and we've got issues that we're dealing with. And there was a recent report that came out by the International Energy Agency, and I will refer to my written testimony, that talks about economic impacts associated with this. And it says, for every $1 of investment in cleaner technology that is avoided in the power sector before 2020, so that means any dollar that we don't spend prior to 2020 on clean tech is going to require an additional $4.30 after 2020 to compensate for the increased emissions. So in order to deal with the problem, we either pay some now and feel some of the pain, or we pay a whole lot more later and perhaps can't turn that problem around. So that was just issued within the last few days.
Now, beyond the economics of power and that debate, there are other things that are of concern, environmental issues that are of concern. Again, I would like to point out a report that was written by the Oregon Climate Assessment Group back in November of 2010 and delivered to the legislature. And in that particular report, they predicted that climate change would result in less rainfall, more wildfires, warming ocean temperatures, acidification, ultimately that disrupts the natural food chain of which we are a part.
I am very sympathetic to the climate change argument, but I want to make sure that we address the specifics of the rules and the process.
So with that in mind, I think we need to look at the fact that renewable energy is a solution that provides both the economic and the environmental benefits. And what we're trying to debate here seems to put the two at cross purposes. Renewable energy can be developed in rural parts of Oregon. It can be done on areas of land, as Representative Bentz pointed out, greater than 100 acres. When we've got non-high-value lands that are of no use to landowners today, this is one of the best opportunities for them to make productive use of it. So that would be my argument, and I will defer to my colleagues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is John Audley. I'm the Deputy Director of the Renewable Northwest Project. In the 18 years we've been around, our fleet of solar, wind, and geothermal facilities now power over 1.3 million homes. That's more power than our nuclear fleet in this region, and has brought $5.5 billion of investments to the state of Oregon. I want to begin by thanking John and his colleagues and the governor's office for their efforts to find common ground among stakeholders. So we spent a lot of time working on this. I think we became friends over time, and we appreciate the changes that they offered. RNP dedicated two staff people to this exercise from the very beginning, our in-house counsel and my in-house smart guy, Adam, who's with me now. But if the goal of the exercise is to help put responsibly sited, responsibly sized solar facilities on the ground in Oregon, we still have a few steps to take. I'm going to bring two points up specifically. The first issue is with regard to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife insistence on mitigating for any species that it determines is appropriate for mitigation during the consultation with a developer. We at RNP are big on making sure that impact is paid for, and we spend a lot of time with our for-profit members making sure that they understand that and use best practices when developing a project. But without sideboards, say, for example, the threatened and endangered species list of both the United States government and the state of Oregon, to act as some kind of sideboard, it's difficult for a developer to understand just what to expect when they're figuring out whether or not a project such as a solar project is going to pencil out, because the margins on these projects are remarkably thin. The second issue is the 100-acre exemption that we've discussed so far. I understand the wind sidelines and happy to talk to you about them. It's our sense from talking to our solar developers that a project that will fit within a 100-acre footprint simply is too difficult to build and operate profitably at this time, given the price of power and what it costs to build a project. These two issues will further retard solar development in Oregon, and I'm pleased to hear that the agency is willing to work forward on this. We will be here to work with them, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam. I'm David Brown. I'm a senior principal with Obsidian Finance Group. And yes, we are still committed to building two of Oregon's largest solar projects. We have a lot of promising work going on right now, and I'm trying to be very optimistic that we can get it done. that's just about it for Oregon's larger scale solar inventory, a 2-megawatt project in Lakeview and a 5-megawatt project in Christmas Valley. Everything else has stopped, and this rule will unfortunately prevent anything from getting started. The wildlife idea can't be explained. It's any species, whether we've previously identified it or not. After you hire a biologist to think about whatever they might think about, I mean, nobody will fund that. Nobody will do that. Nobody will come here. The big federal subsidy expires in 2016. In order to get that subsidy, you have to have your project built by the end of 2016. I'm telling you, that is not much time. The BPA is now saying it's 4 years to get approval from the BPA to hook onto their system. All of sunny Oregon is in BPA service territory, with a couple of exceptions where there used to be lumber mills, where PP&L provides the power. So to get into the BPA queue, you have to have a site. To get a site, you have to know that it's legal. It's impossible to tell in less than 2 years under this rule whether any site is going to be approved or not. And so you just can't build solar in Oregon. And all this I did my best to explain, and I was told that, you know, we have to be patient and these things take steps. And so that's why I came to several of you and urged the adoption of 3595 earlier this year. When that process stopped, the two co-chairs and Representative Huffman wrote a letter to the LCDC commissioners asking them to look at the policies of 3595 and incorporate those into the rule. I'd like to report on three things that I thought the rule missed that 3595 covered. Number one is the fish and wildlife issue, which RNP has explained. Number two is the 100 acres. Now, there is a legitimate disagreement about what the law is. The solar siting statute says two things. Number one, it says if you're a solar collection facility, then you're under FSEC jurisdiction at 100 acres. It says if you're a solar facility, you're under FSEC jurisdiction at 105 megawatts, which is 800 acres. Well, why does it say 100 acres and 800 acres? Well, people who know about solar would say that a solar collection facility is the older thermal facility based on mirrors and steam and an industrial process and a steam generator, and that's what was being built in California when the statute was passed. Photovoltaic, I think, is the 105 megawatt exception. So it's a matter of understanding what the statute really means, because both things are in the statute, and 3595 clarified that, and I think the LCDC felt that it really wasn't their jurisdiction to try to understand the jurisdiction issue. So that's the second point. Then the third point, and I was one of the petitioners who asked the LCDC to please adopt a rule, is that we wanted the rule to say where these things should go. And it doesn't say that. It says where they shouldn't go, but it never addresses, okay, where do we want to put these? And 3595 said along a power line, along a road, and preferably where the ground has already been disturbed, like with the center pivot, but isn't currently in commercial production. Your bill made it clear no cropland gets disturbed. And the reason we got the Oregon Natural Desert Association to support our bill is because they want it on disturbed pivots, old pivots that are no longer being pumped because the water rights have been moved someplace else because the soil quality is so poor. That's where there's going to be the least impact on wildlife, the least impact on cultural resources. It's already alongside a road. It's not natural desert. And the pivot was served with a power line, so there's probably a power line there. So I think I would urge the committee to take up its work, and let's try to adopt a rule. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the explanation. Questions for this panel? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Audley, you indicated that 100 acres is too small. Ideally, what would developers be looking at if they were to begin initiating projects?
Co-chairs, Representative Witt, As is often the case, companies have different opinions.
Yeah.
And I'm not a developer, David is. What I can say is that based on our conversations with our solar members, and given current prices and market demand, we would like to see something that would grant that would not require the Goal 3 exception for in the neighborhood of 20 megawatts, 25 megawatts of power. So we're talking about 200 to 300 acres. I hear what David is saying with regard to interpretation of current statute, and having spent a fair amount of time with the Department of Energy and with the Energy Facility Siting Council, wonder if perhaps there's a way to clarify that by going to the right agency with jurisdiction over whether or not we're talking about old technology solar or newer technology solar.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the time. I will close the informational hearing on siting solar facilities and EFU lands, and that leads us very nicely as we think about the state's energy future, where we're going, and the policies that facilitate or impede that future, into a discussion of our emerging 10-year energy strategy. So I will open an informational hearing on the process overview of that 10-year energy strategy. And we have Michael Jung to join us here. Mr. Nelson, did you want to join as well? Great. Michael Jung and Scott Nelson will be joining us. And Mr. Jung, I will let you tell the committee your title. And thank you for making the time to come down to Salem. I know you're not normally here.
Bailey, Coach Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Michael Jung. I am here today in my capacity as chair for the 10-year energy plan task force, but in my day job, I work as a policy director at a company called Silver Spring Networks, and I'm also a member of the board for an organization here in Oregon called Smart Grid Oregon. With that, I'll defer to Scott Nelson to lay the context for the work of our 10-year energy plan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. And to the co-chair and the committee. I'm Scott Nelson. I work for the governor. And over the past year, a part of my portfolio has been energy issues. Back during the gubernatorial campaign in 2010, as we took on any number of energy issues, the governor said to us staffers, you know, it would be very nice to have a context for talking about some of these energy issues over the long term, because we're talking about big investments in infrastructure, patient capital, and so on and so forth. We need a plan. And so starting then, we started formulating what we thought such a plan would look like, or what a process would look like for developing such a plan for the state of Oregon. And so in the past 3 or 4 months, we've spent time putting together such a process, identifying those like Michael who might want to lend a helping hand to an initial part of the process. And I will stop there and just say that I am extremely pleased to have Michael helping with this effort, and I think that he can help walk you through the procedural portion of what we are engaging in.
Great.
Thank you, Scott. Why 10 years? As Scott noted, energy is a very big picture sort of issue. We tend to think politically in terms of 2-year increments, maybe 4 at best, but energy is best thought of in terms of decades. And so with that in mind, the 10-year energy plan seeks to supersede, to transcend the normal time constraints of business as usual, and to think in terms of this coming decade and where we need to be at the end of 10 years from today. It's an ambitious target. It's an ambitious goal to envision what 10 years from today might look like. I think any of us 10 years ago would have struggled to imagine the kinds of activities, conveniences, technologies that we might even take for granted today. But nonetheless, the governor has set forth an ambitious responsibility to the members of this task force to think big, to think far, to think 10 years ahead. The task force is comprised of 5 distinct, what we're calling design teams. Energy, as some of you may be familiar, is an issue, an area that's
suffers from silos, as I like to call them, in which people tend to get caught up in their own little bubbles and tend not to be able to see past each other's respective silos. With that in mind, we tried to set up design teams that would help people to cut across different silos, their traditional narrow visions, and work together. The five teams that we've set up are first on the consumption side, what we're calling energy efficiency and demand management, but think of it as the consumption side of the equation. On the supply side of the equation, we have set up two teams. The first is a resource mix team, and the second, indicating the particular challenges posed by this specific issue, is a siting team to address siting issues. Of course, energy is not just electricity, it's not just natural gas, but we also have to consider the other roughly 40% of the energy equation, which is transportation. Transportation has its own dedicated design team within the 10-year energy plan task force framework. And last but not least, the governor has made it clear that this is not going to be just another report that ends up on a shelf gathering dust. In fact, he has set forth a design team that has the specific charge of making recommendations on an administrative structure, a way to implement the recommendations that will be coming out of this team. We call this the governance team. And the governance team has the virtue of being populated with the three vice chairs of this task force. And so they have the ability to float in between any and all of the design teams. So those are the five design teams that we have in our 10-year energy plan task force framework. Let me be clear that the task force is charged with making recommendations to the governor. The task force is not making the policy for the 10-year energy plan. With that in mind, we have assembled a group of individuals. We have assigned them to specific design teams. We are fortunate here in Oregon to have an abundance of experts, people with experience, people with helpful perspectives. And so we could have begun and populated the entire task force with all of these knowledgeable people. But we believe that we would have very quickly raced to the lowest common denominator and been held up by process rather than moving swiftly, which we believe is imperative in this day and age to move quickly. Other states, other countries are racing forward, and Oregon is in no position to sit on its heels and wait. And so we have populated our design teams with handpicked individuals. They have been specifically instructed to use and build upon their experiences and perspectives, but to all extents possible, take off their organizational hats and to put on their thinking caps. And so our design team members are approaching this with the perspective of how do I put to use everything that I've learned, everything that I know, and not to think of it in terms of what agenda am I pursuing in my day job. And I believe with confidence.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Mr. John. Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a list of the folks that are on the design team in the task force? Is that something available today?
The design team membership, the roster, if you will, is very near finalization. We are planning to have what we call a charge document that will be finalized concurrently, and that will be made publicly available. We are planning to launch a website, a web presence, so that this information will be available not just to the committee, but to the public at large.
But
and
not
to
today.
Encourage, but not today.
I understand. Thank you. Thank
we are early
you.
In the Thank process.
You. Please continue.
Where I was talking about the perspectives that we are encouraging the design team members to adopt in this work. You're probably wondering about timeline. The timeline for the design or for the Energy Plan Task Force is as follows. The work has recently just gotten underway. Many of the design teams have had their first in-person work session. There are a number of them that will have their first in-person work session this Friday. So the work is in its early stages. The design or the task force will deliver its recommendations to the governor toward the end of January. The governor and his office will consider these recommendations and begin a stakeholder process on his energy plan interpretation beginning in early March. And we are looking at finalization of an energy plan for the state of Oregon for the next 10 years in the middle of May of 2012. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and would welcome any questions from the committee.
Great. Thank you. Questions from the committee? I have a couple myself. If you could talk a little bit about the goals and the outcomes for the 10-year energy plan? We have a list of the different teams and the areas which they're covering. Is there a consistent set of metrics across teams, whether it's energy produced or jobs or climate or any of the metrics by which this committee might measure success or evaluation of the plan that you could speak to?
Thank you for the question, Representative Bailey. The challenge in making things as measurable as we would normally like them to be is that the energy issues are often challenged by the fact that, you know, jobs produced in energy need to be viewed in terms of net jobs as we transition to new technologies, as we modernize our infrastructure. Things will look different almost assuredly 10 years from now than they did 10 years ago. We also look at energy as not just a sector or an industry in and of itself, but really as the fundamental enabler of the modern economy. And so in doing so, we recognize that, you know, because energy, to use an analogy, is like the oxygen of the modern economy, what we do in energy needs to be viewed in the larger prism of how it affects our economy, how it accelerates Oregon's race to prosperity. So we are trying to look big picture and not narrow ourselves with measurable objectives as much as we would like to have each team have quantifiable visions of where we need to be in 10 years. And to make recommendations on specific policies that we can enact, actions that we can take beginning in May of 2012, so that we can propel ourselves toward that. As much as we would like to have consistent, measurable outcomes, we are looking at things like, you know, climate change, emissions reductions. We are looking at, you know, economic development and job impacts. We are looking at each of these things, but we are not saying each team, you have a quota. Here's where we want you to be. Here's the number we want you to hit. Figure out how to get there. We thought that would be too narrowing for a process that we want to keep flexible and open-minded.
But do I hear you correctly that there are parameters for consideration, reliability and affordability and energy production and jobs and climate and those sorts of things?
Absolutely. The parameters, the boundaries, or the directives will be visible in the charge documents that we will be finalizing in the next week or so. And I hope that I can tell you now that reliability, affordability, you know, all of those kinds of paradigms are very much included in this.
Excellent. Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I really look forward to the outcome of your efforts. And I share some of the Co-Chair's thoughts in wondering exactly where it's going to go. I did look at, we do have kind of an energy plan now in the state, and I did fight my way through it a couple of years ago. I mean, the only goals I can think of, I think you just said, which is more and cheaper. And beyond that, I'm just wondering how you're going to direct your group. Because I can think about, we've heard a bunch of issues this morning that all have to do with different aspects of the energy challenge that we face. So I would really like to see that charge to your group. I mean, that we're going to get whatever you ask them to bring you. And so I'd sure like to see that charge.
We will certainly share the charge. This committee will be the first to receive it. We will make it available publicly so that it will be, you know, visible and transparent as to the direction that we are launching this crew in. That said, I am eager to see the outcomes of the group's work as well. We are not presupposing any sort of predetermined outcomes. We are really looking to having gathered the best and the brightest in the state and are looking forward to the outcomes that they recommend. I have encouraged the team members, for what it's worth, not to think in terms of incrementalism, not to just take, you know, the previous initiatives and task forces and blue ribbon panels, et cetera, and to recycle those, but to build upon them and to take leaps of faith where necessary so that we can see ourselves 10 years from now in a very different energy paradigm than the one we have today.
Thank you. You mentioned that the task forces are making recommendations to the governor's office but not actually creating the plan. What happens once those recommendations are made? How do we get to a plan?
With that, I'll defer to Scott, who is in the governor's office.
Right. The design teams will issue recommendations. We'll have some time to review, and then we'll have a robust stakeholder process. I think it's planned for nearly 2 months. And out of that, I think that we'll have all the information that we need to have to quickly turn a document and a plan for legislation and administrative regulatory changes and anything else that might fit within those parameters by the summer.
And I heard, Mr. Jung, in your comments, a desire that I share, that this effort not result in a plan that will live on a shelf, but be an implementable plan. I share that goal. In getting to that, Mr. Nelson, you mentioned legislation. I imagine we have a 10-year plan, and somewhat analogous to the 20-year plan, 20-year lookout with a 5-year IRP. We have a 10-year plan that I would assume is broken into essentially implementable 2-year chunks, because for better or for worse, this body does operate on a 2-year cycle by definition, and that those implementable chunks might end up in this committee, might end up in other relevant committees, or wherever they need to end up in order to build the fabric of the framework for this energy plan. Is that the vision?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is the vision, and to have a scalable recommendations, have a scalable recommendation so that it can be played out over time. And this is not the kind of thing that gets done in a single legislative session. But I do think that the timing that we have finishing in the summer, it's pretty obvious that we will have immediate recommendations, I think. And by finishing in summer, I think that we believe that there will be time to spin up those ideas for the legislative session in 2013.
Mr. Kutcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can see why you're excited to have Mr. Jung on your team, and I appreciate the update. I appreciate that you're not quite ready. We're eager for you to move forward, and I want to be supportive and not critical. We meet one more time before the February session, and to your point, you're obviously not planning on a major agenda for February. Right. However, we'd be very interested in another update. I think I'm speaking for my co-chair as well, in February, even if it was just along these lines, but once you formed the design teams and so forth. And please keep us informed where it's appropriate by paper. We'll make sure that the committee has it. I don't know what else you've been goofing around with in the governor's office, but this is important. And this, you know, getting Oregon's plan together is very important. And also, you're on record, sir, as saying that we'll be the first to know, which I expect means that the Senate Energy Environment Committee will be second to get the report.
Put that in your planner. I will see what I can do with email, sir. If I may make one more remark to the committee.
Please.
I appreciate the eagerness and enthusiasm. To the extent that I would urge a little bit of realism, we have given our team precious little time to develop their recommendations, matters of weeks, for processes that normally would take months, if not a full year. With that in mind, we have asked them for direction, for a sense of where the compass should be pointing, and to expect sort of a detailed play-by-play for each year or each session in the 10-year horizon. Maybe too much to expect, but certainly I think, as Scott pointed out, we will be looking for things that are actionable in 2013, as early as 2013, and certainly we'll have a sense of what are the milestones that we'll need to be hitting, or at least the direction we need to be heading, so that we can end up in 10 years in a better place when it comes to energy.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, there is a part of the plan is actually having a legislative advisory team, and I think that's not quite finalized yet, but I know that our legislative director has talked to leadership about identifying folks who can help out. So we will be in direct touch with the committee, but also there is a formalized communications channel with the legislature.
Okay. Any other questions? Gentlemen, I want to thank you, and this has become a refrain throughout this committee, of thanking the governor's office for working on a number of different issues. So we're keeping them quite busy, Mr. Co-Chair. But I want to thank you both very much for working on this. If you hear from this committee a sense of urgency, it's because we're eager to see this. We're happy that you've taken it on. It's an enormous task. It's a complex task. And the fact that you are going through the process of bringing together a lot of different ideas and inputs and stakeholders is, in a short amount of time, is impressive. We look forward to seeing the outcome. And, Mr. Jung, from what I understand of your background, we're very excited to have you lending your expertise to this process and shepherding it. So we'll look forward to the outcome, and may I say that it's what this the state really needs is a game plan and a playbook and an understanding of where we go from here. Rep. Kenny-Geyer.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say that I was at a college reunion in October and heard from an energy advisor to Governor Cuomo what a great job Oregon was doing and mentioned you. So, you know, we need it as a state, and it's also really putting us on the map nationally. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
And suddenly we're ahead of schedule. So with that, I will close the 10-year energy strategy process overview and open an informational hearing on the energy supplier assessment. Director Repine. Director, did you have anybody else that you wanted to have join you?
That's an endless list of people I'd like to have join me, but I probably won't have them come up.
Well played, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I think there are some handouts that will be coming to you, or do you already have the handouts?
I believe we have them.
Thank you. For the record, I am Bob Repine. I'm the Acting Director for the Department of Energy. I've been asked to present to the committee kind of an update on where we are with the energy suppliers assessment. So I've given you a paper PowerPoint, and I'm going to go through that with you and try to direct you from page to page as I move forward. Today I will cover the history of the ESA, the Energy Supplier Assessment, stakeholder engagement that we've had over the course of time, what ESA supports financially within the department, and some discussion about the 2011 ESA rates that we have put into place as of recent. On your second page, the Energy Supplier Assessment was created back in 1977 to fund the activities of the Department of Energy, a very large category of funding. Again, thinking back in time, 1977, the agency then is probably in many ways far different than the agency that resides in government today for 2011. So people have asked me, what did they really mean by that? I don't know. But the law still says it's designed to support the activities of the Department of Energy. It was amended in the mid-90s to allow the use of the ESA funds to support the activities of the Energy Facility Siting Council, which I'll go into a little more detail in the conversation with you. ESA is a ratio based on a supplier's gross operating revenues derived in Oregon. The rate is statutorily limited to 0.5% of a gross operating revenue. The current rate has been, up till recent, had been 0.069% for the last four annual assessments. And for the 2011 legislative adopted budget, the department increased that rate to 0.085%. The chart is just a simple graphic to show you where the statutory cap resides related to the ESA amount that can be charged and where we currently are with the 0.085 rate today. The next chart is really just another way of presenting the same information to you, however, more of a historical look of the rate over the last 30 years. Also notable is that the rate had not changed in the, as I mentioned earlier, in the last four fee assessments. So you'll see that flat line before it has ticked up on the right-hand side to our current rates of 2011. During our next slide, or next page, during our budget hearings in February of 2011, the Department of Energy alerted the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources and on one-to-one meetings with members of the subcommittee to the fact that it was likely that the Department of Energy would need to increase the ESA fund to fund the governor's recommended budget. The legislative LFO budget summary document subsequently communicated the need to raise $12 million in ESA funds to support the legislative adopted budget. Those budget documents are included with materials provided for you today. A little bit of discussion on the next slide about our stakeholders' engagement. Department of Energy has formed a stakeholder group back in 2010, comprised of various representatives from entities that pay the energy assessment or the representative organizations. So as you see the list there, there are many, many more people, but larger the some of those organizations that are paid individually are being represented by, as an example, the Oregon Municipal Electrical Utilities Association. On the next page, still talking about stakeholder engagement, the stakeholder group launched the first of several meetings in May of 2010. At that time, the department provided stakeholder groups with an overview of the Department of Energy's budget structure, how the department uses the energy supplier assessment, and the department's policy that governs the ESA. In September, we met again where we discussed the 2011-2013 legislative-approved budget, as well as the need and justification for the increase of the ESA rate for this biennium. The stakeholders group has asked Department of Energy to provide detailed budget and historic data. As of yesterday, the group met again to continue our dialogue with the ESA stakeholders. The department is committed to continue these discussions with them to both share information and share a broader understanding of how those resources are used. Next slide is titled, What is ESA Supports in the 2011-13 legislative-approved budget. ESA expenditures occur really across all the sections in the department when no other funding sources are available. That's how we currently use the program. I'll give you an example of that. As you know, we've been managing the federal ARRA fund program in the department. There are certain limitations of what can or cannot be used for those ARRA funds. We had a mandatory training program for workforce sensitivity. We were able to, we needed to train all of our staff, and those our staff were are part of that same staff group. And so for that period of time when they were taking that training, ESA funds would have been used for it because that's not a permissible use using the federal ARRA funds. So we use it as a way to augment or supplement funds that can't reach in certain funding areas. Also in the ESA's budget support activities, in addition to this, the ESA revenues cover our cash flow needs of the agency. And it provides a revenue source to cover unanticipated revenue shortfalls. Given this, the Department of Energy targets maintaining a six-month ending balance to ensure sufficient reserves are available to ensure financial stability for the department. Let me give you an example of what that might be. Historically, the department for our FSEC siting program is a bill-based recapturing of funds for those costs associated for the siting activities. However, the billing is on a billing cycle that we may not see the resources coming from the siting applicant for maybe 60 or 90 days. So we have billing requirements that we need to get out to contractors and subcontractors, and so we use a float, the best way to describe it, of these resources to help make those billings available. And then when the money comes in, we reload those funds in order to keep the agency moving ahead in an appropriate fashion. Give you an example on the next slide, talking about some of the controlling activities we have put into place over the last couple of years. The Department of Energy was able to reduce the ESA expenditures by approximately $200,000 during the 2009-11 biennium. Beginning in July of 2011, the department modified the fee and account structure within the facility siting to ensure more appropriate, complete, and timely cost recovery. These changes will further reduce the need for ESA support for supporting siting activities. The department redeployed ESA funds already programmed in the budget to the Governor's School Initiative during the first quarter of 2009-2011 biennium to support these activities rather than request new funds. The department established an ESA allotment program within its managing process, giving managers the tools they need to monitor ESA expenditures. Historically, that never was done. The department has committed to providing stakeholders with update and on expenditures prior to the next assessment cycle and will consider any input from that stakeholder group on how we proceed. Mr. Chairman, a short but brief assessment of the program. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the director? Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, just being sure nobody else. Thanks for being here. We missed you last time, but we appreciate you coming back this time. I want to start with maybe this one sheet on the handout, make sure I understand it. What ESA supports in the 2011 and 13 is on two sheets, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Can you tell me, Mr. Director, what of those programs or areas are mandated by the department to pay for through ESA?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, mandated in the sense of statutory requirements?
Correct.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Co-Chair, at a glance, I suppose short of the director's office and communication, agency's infrastructure, the rest are either components of the existing language of the charge of this agency and or specific activities that have been denoted through modifications to that language. Examples would be this assembly voted on the Cool Schools program through House Bill 2960. We are currently, I suppose one could take exception to, we list the governor's energy policy advisor and the 10-year energy planning process, the presentation you just heard before. While that's not a statutory directive, but I think the committee had expressed themselves, and I would think I would interpret this correctly, as a very important aspect of energy planning for the state of Oregon. In order to do that, there's resources and staffing and costs that are associated with it, and there was none identified in the biennium process, the budgeting process, and therefore we believe that this is an important part for the department to be involved in, and those funds are being used to assist my staff, who is staffing all five of those committees, to make sure that it's being done in a meaningful and timely way.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. We touched briefly on this in the last meeting. You weren't here, but and it wasn't completely clear to me. You brought up the 10-year energy planning, which you just heard, and I'm eager for that to happen. You also, I think, are mandated to do an energy plan. And we talked a little bit last time, but you're going to have to go into it a little bit more. How can we, if we're paying for two energy plans for the state of Oregon, is there a way to coordinate those? Because I think ESA funds in your office are paying for both what the department's supposed to do and the task, what do we call them, the group just previous?
The design teams.
The design teams.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members, good question. The agency has presented on a continued basis an energy plan document for the state of Oregon for probably the better part of 30 years. I know it was around when I think Diane Enright had presented it during the session. It is a cost that I'm sure is derived for the payment of through the ESA funds. I would envision, again, not knowing the outcome, as Mr. Young talked about what the group is working on and where they're going to go with this, our plan is a plan that looks back over the last 2 years and tells the reader what has been accomplished, what could be accomplished in a more different fashion. It's more of a report out, and I think if you looked at it over time, you would see that. I think Diana mentioned, because I was sitting with her at the time, what we hope from the result of the 10-year planning process is more than a plan. We're hoping for a strategy. Our charge by the law is to report a 10-year energy plan for the state of Oregon, which has
taken on a look of what have we done in the past, what are we going to do in the future. Not as far-reaching, I think, as this 10-year energy plan that Mr. Jung and the design teams will be working on. My hope would be that that becomes the new format for us to fold our information that we have built over time into a much more robust approach to talking about strategies of how do you accomplish this as opposed to just reporting out the results. So my goal would be not to have two reports, but to actually marry those two processes together so we have a better planning strategy report that we would submit to the legislature.
Mr. Chair, I've got a number of questions and, you know, issues about this, and we've talked about it, and I'm going to hold fire for now, but I would like to say on the record for the committee, I think this is a really important issue, and I think it's important that we understand it. And I am not here to just shoot it down, but, you know, the ESA, I think, preceded your legislative career. These things happen in other legislatures, and sometimes the answer is why are they still here? It's because nobody bothered to go back and examine them. So I'm interested in how much money there is there. Ultimately, these things get passed on to ratepayers. There are obviously some important things going on, but we need clarity about how much, where the money's going, and that sort of thing. And do we need to revisit this and put some sideboards on it to make sure that we're not just going along, stumbling along in an account that is unmanageable? So I have concerns about it, but I'm hoping the committee will dig in, and we will continue down this path. I appreciate the director being here.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I have a sneaking suspicion that this will continue to be on the committee's radar screen. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Chair. Director, it says here the ESA is a ratio based on the energy supplier's annual. The definition of energy supplier, you may have said that, and I just wasn't paying attention.
Anybody who provides an energy service, and it also includes petroleum as well, so people who are producing, generating power.
Follow-up. And that doesn't include someone that has solar panels on their roof.
No, sorry. A commercial application.
It has to be a commercial.
Large. Selling to the grid probably would be a good way to describe it, or selling the power to some other use, or consuming it for sale.
Excluding feed-in tariffs.
Feed-in tariff, correct.
Follow-up. And so the new wind facilities and things like all the green power things we're seeing going in that may have entered into a contract with California, let's say, to buy their power, they're paying part of this.
I don't know if I have that answer for you relative to somebody who's a generator who's producing it and selling it in California. Don't know if I'm getting any eyes from my staff in the background. We're all not. There's a general nodding in the back. So yes, I guess that's correct.
One last follow-up, and this is consistent with Co-Chair Gillum's point, and that is some sort of linkage between those who are paying and what we're spending the money on. Going back to the original statute, we've had this discussion before. Okay. It does look like there's been some drift, but I don't know that for sure. And so it would be great to see who's paying it, how much, and then how those tie together. And I can see the attempt to do it, and I appreciate that, putting together the engagement of the stakeholders and so forth. That looks like a great idea, but from our standpoint, or I share Co-Chair Gilliam's concern about whether or not I don't clearly understand the who's paying and what we're getting piece. So I'll look forward to further discussing that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. Representative, I understand that both interest and concern. As you remember, I made my opening comments whenever this was created back in 77. I don't know if there is anybody who's around who can tell you what the intent was, other than what the law says, is that the ESA funds was to support the activities of the agency. And maybe back in 77, it was that simple. As you fast forward to 2011 and beyond, I think the activity of the department has changed dramatically. I mean, it has always had core activities, but I think just the involvement of the new renewable activities has changed us dramatically over time. So having a discussion about the rate today as it pertains to the activity of the department. I think that's a good discussion. One of the efforts that we are engaged with the stakeholders is really to become, as it's a cliche, but transparent with them. We have found that many of our stakeholders who have been longtime friends of the department have never understood or have ever had a chance to see what the budgeting process is for the department and how money flows to certain activities. Prior to the last 2 years, this agency was, the way I've described it to others, and I will describe it to you, was an agency that had one pot of money. And while we had many sources of money, we had one pot we held it in. And so money was just put into the pot. And then dependent on the activity, people would reach in, simplifying this, reach in and take the money they needed to go do the task. We've changed that this biennium, where we actually have five budgeting criteria or five budgets that follow the divisions, and where we're able to segregate out exactly where the ESA funds do go or don't go and to what extent they are being used. And then what we're doing is analyzing those resources against where we have other funds and say, are we being as efficient as we can in raising the funds necessary to cover the cost of an operation to minimize the cost that might be now leaking over to the ESA funds. So a good example would be in siting. We had a very old, tired billing process that we didn't manage very well. And we have changed that in a way that we believe matches both our needs and probably is a little bit better reflection for our customers' needs. It is more timely. It's more relative to what they're asking of services for us in a timely fashion. In doing so, we find we get better billing denotations from our staff, which means we're not having to supplement with ESA funds. So just by those simple management modifications and tracking modifications, we're able to account very close on where ESA funds are being used or not used in this case. And so we see as we move forward, as we get more traction with this new budgeting process that we've developed for the agency, we'll be able to make those adjustments and tightening up on our programs where other fees do come in, but for whatever reason, we maybe not have been as aggressive as we have should have been in collecting those other fees. And so it's a combination, I think, of change of scope of the agency over 40 years and a change of management structure of how you account for those resources that will, in the end of the day, give our stakeholders a very crisp look at how every dollar is spent if related to the ESA funds.
If I may, the point I was getting at is originally the thought was you've got an energy supplier is creating difficulty here that we need to clean up for a nuclear plant. The energy supplier created the mess, will have the sales of energy help pay to clean up the mess. Pretty clear linkage between those two, the raising of the money and the cleanup of the mess. Now, what I'm looking at now is, what's the justification for having the energy suppliers paying this fee for the services that are, I'm not disputing the need for the services, I'm just trying to see where that linkage is. And that's what, I don't need to belabor the point further, I just need to be clearer on understanding why that group of people is being selected to pay for this type of services, as opposed to a broader group. And this is a very old conversation, and I still don't think I have the answer in this particular context.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, and I think that's really the issue that we are working with the stakeholders on. They are asking those same questions. Why are we spending money here when we can't make the connection of why? So we're trying to walk that with them to say, here's why we're doing it. Here's why we believe it's of value to the department in the state of Oregon and why it still fits within the context of allowable expenditure of the ESA funds as it pertains to the department. But a good discussion, we might find that that isn't the case. And so I think it's a learning process both from the agency's perspective to have a new look at how the suppliers, people who are paying these fees, are feeling about the fees, and have them have a better look on how we're using or expensing those fees to see if there's where the common points are.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I particularly want to compliment the director on, I'd heard about the discussions with the stakeholders, the informal discussions, and I appreciate you doing that. I hope that our committee in some positive way helped push that conversation, and I hope that we can at least, if not be part of it, hear back from you on how that's going, because I think it's critical, and I'm very pleased that you've opened up those lines of communication.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate that. I think I'll give you credit. I'm sure that your inquisitiveness about this has caused us to move forward to this. But when I took over this position, it was clear when I met with some of the stakeholders that they really wanted to get a better grasp of how their funds are being spent. So I think a combination of from their interest and your raising this issue, we are down this road, and we expect to see better results as we move forward.
Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Appreciate it.
Close the informational meeting on the energy supplier assessment. And is Palmer here? He is here. There he is. We are going to open an informational report on Oregon's paint product stewardship law. Okay. Mr. Mason, we're going to ask you to begin by saying paint product stewardship law three times fast.
Ooh. Wow.
We'll spare you.
That could be challenging. So.
Please begin.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey and Co-Chair Gilliam and committee members. I'm here because you've asked to get an update on the legislative report that we have produced on the Oregon Paint Product Stewardship Program. Maybe I'll say it just once and not twice more. That's why I'm here today. So we will go through these slides and do that. All right, you see, I want you to know I put you first before the Senate. I hope you saw that.
Oh, she's left.
You see. So why paint? Why in 2009 did the legislature adopt this pilot program? Turns out that paint is the largest component of the household hazardous waste that we see in Oregon. It also turns out that paint is a recyclable product, and we weren't doing a very good job of recycling that product in Oregon. There were local government facilities that were collecting it, but the infrastructure wasn't very extensive and statewide, and there wasn't a lot of communication about the opportunities that we have with this product to recycle. And you can recycle latex paint, and what we do with oil-based paint is use it for energy recovery. So that was the genesis of looking at this. And a lot of credit goes to the paint industry. This was some legislation that they brought to Oregon because they are on a national rollout to bring product stewardship type programs throughout the country to manage the leftover paint. And it turns out Oregon was the place that they first passed the legislation, and we have the first in the nation program to manage paint in this way. And that was House Bill 3037. Just the program started July of 2010, and it will sunset in June of 2014. And the way the program works is Paint Care, which is a nonprofit set up by the American Coatings Association, is a stewardship organization that collects a fee that is put on every container of architectural paint. And so this is the paint that you use for painting the interior and exteriors of buildings. A fee that's put on every container of paint in Oregon. They collect that fee and use that fee to set up an infrastructure for collection, recycling, and safe disposal. They also use those dollars to promote the program and make consumers aware of it. And at point of sale, which is where the fee is collected, retailers are required to give information to consumers or provide information on what their opportunities are to collect, recycle, and safely dispose. The fee ranges from 35 cents to $1.60, and the fee gets larger as you move into a larger size of the container. One aspect of the bill was for DEQ to come back to the legislature and provide this report.
I interrupt you for a second, Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said the folks selling it are required or prompted or suggested to tell folks about the recycling When did that start? Did that start this summer or earlier?
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, yes, the retailers are required to provide information at point of sale about the opportunity to collect and recycle, and that was something that started when the program started.
And when was that? Follow-up. When was that?
The program started July 2010. That's when when I say the program started, that was the first date that Paint Care was required to provide infrastructure for consumers to take back the leftover paint.
I've had occasion to buy quite a bit of paint over the last year, and I don't think I've ever heard it. Is it, I won't say what town I'm buying it in. I'll make one up. Eugene, I'm lying. Should we be? Excuse me.
Two buzzers.
Yeah. Thank you. So is it taking a while to get the word out?
I think Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, I think you put your finger on a problem that we've seen in the program, that not all retailers are providing that information at point of sale. And that's a pretty key issue, because we're not going to see high collection rates unless the consumer is well-informed about the opportunity to use the program. And so we have seen that issue. Others have brought that same issue to us. Paint Care, I think, has done a pretty good job of providing the information to the retailers, but the way the law is written, the ultimate responsibility rests on the retailer to provide that information at point of sale. The obligation in statute is on a retailer to provide that. So,
thank you. Representative Thompson.
I have to second that comment. I buy a lot of paint out in Ontario, and I asked that question of a retailer what they had on paint recycling, and they said they had nothing. And it was a large retailer. So we don't have the penetration, I think, that we'd like to have.
All right.
Representative, are you saying there's not a sufficient coat of information?
Something like that, yes. Good wording, yes. There may be some work to be done yet.
No. And co-chairs and Representative Thompson, yes, I hear you, and I think that is something that we've heard loud and clear from folks. So.
Palmer, I just want to add one more flag, as I don't want to interrupt your PowerPoint too much, but I think this committee would probably be interested too, and certainly I would be, in a little bit more discussion you may be getting there on the retail-oriented nature of this program. Not only success or lack thereof in getting the word out to retailers and getting retailers to get the word out then to their customers, but also in retail acceptance of return paint products and whether or not that is a model that's effective currently.
Okay, and if I can, maybe I'll address that as I get through the slides, but I will be sure to address that issue.
Thank you.
All right, so I quickly wanted to give you the overall findings from the program. So you see here, this was the amount of gallons that were collected through the program, you know, over 460 gallons, the number of sites, and actually that number is a little dated. That's a number from June 30th of this year. We actually are closer to 100 collection sites. And then the percentage of latex paint that was recycled, and then one of the findings, or one of the results of this, I should say, was the fact that by having the industry collect the cost through the consumer to provide for the end-of-life management for paint, local governments realize savings in their household hazardous waste programs. Let me speak, if I can, a little bit more to the 460,000 gallons that were collected. That number is actually not much more, based on the estimates that we were able to do, than the amount of paint that was collected prior to this program. So that's a significant finding, and I think we will speak to it more when I get to the recommendations. In fact, by our estimates, it's only a 3% increase from the amount of paint that was collected prior to the program. I think there are several reasons for that, and again, we're going to explore a little bit more of that in the recommendations, but it is a brand new program. It was the first year of a pilot project. The fact that you several of you pointed out, I went to buy paint and I didn't have information and didn't realize that this program was out there. Speaks to one of the limitations and one of the reasons why that collection rate wasn't very high. So it was a new program, but this is an area that I think, at least from the department's perspective, that should be a key focus of future legislation, is ensuring that that collection rate is driven up. I mean, after all, folks are paying the fee, paying the assessment, and then the whole point of paying the assessment was to see that the paint didn't get thrown into the landfill, but was actually recycled, or in the case of oil-based paint, was used for energy recovery. So that's a key finding. I just wanted to draw your attention to that. I think there's an outcome that was on the more positive side was the next bullet, in that now we have it, and again, that number is a little dated, closer to 100 collection sites. That more than doubled the number of collection sites that we had prior to the program. So I think we're setting the stage for a successful program, but in our estimation, the program's not there yet. The infrastructure is being put in place, but we're going to need more education, more outreach. We're going to need to make some other changes to drive that collection rate higher. But again, those are just some key findings that I wanted to point out to the committee. I'll move on then. All right. So some overall findings from the program also were, I'll go back to, I said that we did an estimate that the program resulted in a sort of a 3% increase in collection volumes. I do need to caution that a little bit. There were not good metrics prior to 2010 about how paint was collected in Oregon. There wasn't a single consistent metric that was used. With this program, and again, we only have the first year of data, we actually had a single metric to measure consistently statewide how much paint was collected. That was one of the positive outcomes of this program, is we now have a baseline in which to measure future program performance against. So I wanted to point that out. We'll clearly need a second year's data, and we will get the second year's data September of 2012, and that will be useful if the legislature agrees that this program is worth making permanent. We'll have that additional data. There were surveys done by Paint Care that indicated the majority of Oregonians value this program. They think it's a worthwhile service, although, again, there are, as that last bullet indicates, plenty of areas for improvement, and there's going to be a real need to establish some clear metrics and measures to ensure that the money people are paying is spent in a way that actually gets us some real environmental gains. So now, if I can, I'll shift over to the recommendations. So what you'll see in the subsequent slides here are recommendations that DEQ developed based on looking at the annual report that was provided to us by Paint Care in September. Our evaluation of that annual report, we had a stakeholder meeting October the 18th, and there was an opportunity for stakeholders to look at our draft recommendations, and they provided feedback. And then we also gave those stakeholders and the public an opportunity to provide us written comments, which have been attached to the report that I sent out by email. They were given that opportunity up until November the 1st. So all those things fed into these recommendations. And the first recommendation is that we do suggest to the legislature that this program be made permanent, with the proviso that, and you'll see them in the subsequent slides, these recommendations and these issues be dealt with, either the recommendations that we're making or similar recommendations. So, because as I said, we think the program has been set up where there's a platform for success, but we haven't achieved success yet, and there's some changes that need to be made, critical changes that need to be made in order to ensure a successful program. So what you see here is a generalized map of where we have collection sites in Oregon. That map is, again, a little dated. We actually have a higher amount of collection sites. So the first recommendation is we need to improve collection convenience. Recycling programs only work well if it's easy for people to recycle, if the opportunities are convenient. That's a key truism of the recycling world. So what we're recommending is that in statute there be a fairly clear standard about how many collection sites we would see in Oregon. You all are
pretty familiar with our eCycles program, which under that law specifies the number of collection sites there are per county and per city. So our thought is a model like that would be very useful. It would be very clear to the industry, to the public, to the legislature about the type of convenience that we would get. And that, so again, you look at setting a standard in statute based on geographic population, and we're recommending taking it down to the county level. So that's the first key recommendation. The second key recommendation is to ensure that all of the costs of the program are covered. And what this diagram shows you is the breakdown, the per container breakdown of the assessment. So as you, again, go to a larger container, you pay a higher assessment to cover the management cost. On this issue, what we're recommending is the model that PaintCare used, and this may, Co-Chair Bailey, speak a little bit to your question. The model that they used was a retail location model. Most of the sites in the program, I think it's roughly 80 or so out of the 100 sites, are all retail locations. PaintCare did not reimburse the retailers for the service of collecting the paint at their store. There were about 15 or so sites that are the local government household hazardous waste sites. Those were also not reimbursed for the service of collecting the leftover paint. What PaintCare paid for was the transportation and the processing and then the outreach and education. We think a better approach would be for PaintCare, probably mandated in statute, to pay the full cost of the program, including collection costs, to at least to the local governments. And we say that because the local governments, even though they were only 15 facilities out of roughly 15 out of the 100, they collected, I think, about 60% of the volume. And there's some reasons for that that predate PaintCare. Those programs are more established. They're more well-known to people. They are a different service in that people can come in and drop off a lot more paint. You wouldn't come in with 100 gallons of paint probably in your paint store. You'd carry a couple cans in, whereas you can drive your car up to a household hazardous waste facility. So there's some reasons why that works well, but at the same time, in order to promote stability in the program and ensure that all the folks who are going to serve as collectors stay as collectors, they probably ought to be paid for those services. So that's an issue. It may have the effect, though, on the other side of driving up the cost of the assessment. We're running some numbers now to try to give you an estimate on whether we think that'll happen, but that is a potential consequence of saying that the stewardship organization has to pay collection costs is that the assessment goes up. So I'll move on to the next slide. I think this is a very key recommendation here. And what we're trying to say with this recommendation is that in 2009, the legislature deliberately passed a general piece of legislation because this program was a pilot project. It was the first in the country. And we needed general language to adapt and learn and develop the program. Well, now we have a first year, and by the time we get to 2013 and we're talking legislation, we'll have a second year. And I think with that information, based on what we've seen today and we'll probably see in the future, is it's important to have some sideboards on and some expectations in the statute about how the program would be managed. So we might have goals or program measures that specify what are we looking for in reducing the generation of leftover paint. How much reuse do we want to see? What, again, we spoke to it earlier, the convenience standard. We were talking about it on one of the first slides, the collection volumes. Admittedly, the collection volumes have been low, so the statute might set a scale, a sequence of higher and higher collection volumes. I do need to stop and point out, though, if at the same time we're asking the industry to generate less leftover paint, you kind of have a paradox where if you're generating less leftover paint, it's harder to meet a collection standard. So we'll have to, those two things work in tandem. As the industry themselves says, the idea is that you buy only the amount of paint that you need to do the job. That's where they would like the consumer to be. But until we get there, we're going to have leftover paint, and we ought to try to recycle that rather than dump it in the landfill. So another goal could be collection volumes. And again, you see some other goals there, including consumer education, making sure that we have a performance measure that speaks to getting the consumer fully informed about their opportunity. I mean, again, they're paying the fee. They might as well know why they're paying the fee and what the point of that is. So that's the idea behind those measures. I guess in a word, it's really about accountability. That's the point of those program measures there. So trying to move quickly here.
Pause you for 1 second. I would just comment that the collection volume metric, if it's a gross metric, I get the interplay with generation of leftover paint. However, if there's some sort of baseline, clearly if it's a percentage basis, then there isn't an interplay with generation of leftover paint. So I encourage you to look at both the gross volume as well as the percentage of leftover.
Okay.
Representative Benz?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't recall if in your earlier slide you called out the percentage of paint being returned. You called out the number, the gallons. Do we have any idea how much that is as a percentage of total paint sales?
That is a good question, Representative Benz. I don't think I know the answer to that. I know that approximately 10% of the paint that is purchased is left over and sort of unused, but I don't know the answer to the question you're asking. I'll have to find that out.
Well, right. Without that, it's going to be pretty hard for you to use some of your measures here.
Right. Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, I think we have that answer. I just don't personally have it. I think DEQ has that information so that we could try to define those measures. I just can't give you the number today. Am I answering your question?
You are. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, the next slide speaks to amending some of the reporting requirements, extending some deadlines, requiring reporting on the program measures I just talked about, requiring the stewardship organization to identify changes to the plan.
I was trying to think of this question. I think it's come to me. So the return paint, each person pays 50 cents a can currently. If they use the entire can, they don't return it. Total. And so there could be a pileup of extra money for the cans that are completely used. Is that a correct thought?
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, that is a correct statement. I mean, the assessment is levied on every can of paint sold, and it really does fund the collection for purposes of recycling and recovery. Under the law, paint care, and it's a part of the plan, is directed to work on the issue of trying to deal with the generation of paint so that, again, people are only buying the amount of paint they need for the job that they intend to use it for. So there is some language in the bill that speaks to that, but you are right. The folks who really benefit from the program are those who have leftover paint.
Yeah. Follow-up. Well, and this gets us to, we should know just exactly how many 50-cent increments we made. There's a number. Are we going to see that number soon? Has it already gone up there?
I believe it's in the report, and so I can look at it there. I'm trying to remember. Let me look in the back. We have some other charts. I'm trying to remember if I know the actual amount that was sold. I think I would have to find it for you in the report. So, and I will do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Then I'll move on here. So we're also recommending that the covered products be expanded to include aerosol spray paints as well. And I'll move on here. I think this slide will maybe speak to some of the questions and the comments that we had earlier about strengthening the outreach and education component of the program. That was an area that the paint care, I think, made some progress on at a statewide level in doing newspaper ads, radio ads, that type of thing to get the word out generally. But where it may have broken down is at that consumer level when you or I walk in to buy the paint and knowing that here's why we paid the fee and here's what we need to do if we have any leftover paint. That was an area that probably needs quite a bit more work. So that's an issue that we should look on in the future. So I'll move on then to oversight. So what we're recommending here is that the legislature look at potentially specifying in statute that it's an annual plan approval, and this could be important because that allows DEQ to ensure the fee matches the expenditures, the fee revenue matches expenditures, and that the money is being appropriately spent. Also, it's going to be important, at least in our view of it, to get more detailed information on the program costs and what the revenue, the assessment revenue, is actually being spent on. And then finally, the last couple bullets is it's important, we think, to look in the statute to providing some clarity on violations and penalties. Right now, the statute just more or less gives DEQ order authority to direct somebody to take an action. And sort of the ultimate order that we have is to tell someone they can't sell paint. And that is a rather draconian step. And I think we would like some other options to use short of that. Maybe if, not to pick on retailers, but to say there's a recalcitrant retailer out there, to say, well, if you aren't providing information at point of sale, you could face a penalty, and use that as a way to ensure that they're providing that that responsibility. And then also, it may be that we need to look at a process to change the assessment as we move forward to, again, ensure that the revenue coming in matches the expenditures and that we're neither collecting too much or too little. And lastly, the last recommendation here, DEQ recommends that we go back and report to the legislature on the funding mechanism that is used. This per container assessment that we're talking about is what is commonly called an eco fee, an echo fee. So it's levied at point of sale. Our other signature product stewardship program here in Oregon, the eCycles program, uses a different approach. It says to the manufacturers, the e-waste manufacturers, you have a responsibility to manage the products at the end of life, and you figure out a way to pass that cost on to the consumer and manage it without an explicit fee levied at point of sale. So it's another way to fund the program, and it, we think, is worth an evaluation of whether that model might make more sense for paint. So I will stop there and take any questions, and I will say, Co-Chair Bailey, if I didn't fully answer your question on retail, I can try to do that now. If you would like, I can try to respond to that.
That would be great, actually.
Okay. So I think your question was, is this has been a retail-based model. That's how we're doing the collections. I think the DEQ would say, based on what we've seen, one-year data, that's a model that can work. There are some issues with that. The type of issues that we pointed out, are retailers fulfilling their responsibility to educate consumers on their option? There is another difficult issue with that approach, in that the way we've set up this pilot project, and it doesn't necessarily need to be how it's done in future legislation, is the stewardship organization, Paint Care, goes out and seeks voluntary contracts with retail stores in a given county or city, a given location. That could be an issue in that if the Paint Care chooses to select store A and they don't select store B, is store B at a competitive disadvantage now because store A is the site that was selected by Paint Care? And so the business that may be being generated because people are returning the unused paint is going to store A and not to store B. You have to balance that against the fact that if you're asking the stewardship organization to run a cost-effective program, they need some ability to choose the locations and retail locations that make sense. So this is an issue, as I've watched the program in the first year, that has hit me as a real conundrum, because I can see the need for flexibility on the case of Paint Care to manage the program cost effectively and not take every retail location out there. But at the same time, I can see that store A might benefit over store B from a competitive point of view. And to share with the committee, there were some issues where some of the stores raised that, situation of why wasn't I chosen? And so it's a fair question. I don't have an answer to that, but that's one of the difficulties of a retail-based approach.
It strikes me that I appreciate that answer, and that makes sense. Strikes me as well that in addition to the challenge in educating consumers about a retail-based approach, that given that retailers, my understanding is, are not compensated or reimbursed for participation in the program, that they probably also lack some incentive to set up a robust system to educate consumers and to then accept or store paint that is brought back in the system. They are not waste disposal entities. They are in the business of selling a product, and it may be worth a, as part of the evaluation process, evaluating whether or not it makes sense to continue to ask businesses, whether large or small, to play a role that they aren't necessarily accustomed to playing, and whether or not there's better entities for that.
Yeah. If I may, Co-Chair Bailey, I will share with you the retailers that participated in the discussion on this report did express support for the program, and that they thought that it did benefit them. I don't proclaim to know whether that's all retailers would view that the same way. In fact, I know some had a lot of questions about why am I doing this and what is this program. So I do think there's another point of view out there, but I did want to share with you that the ones who participated in this expressed support for the program.
Mr. Co-Chair, you just gave my bottle bill speech. that bill preceded your time.
I was hoping you wouldn't pick up on that.
But I'm fortified by your mm-hmm. attitude.
It also preceded my existence on this planet.
Thank you for that, Mr. Co-Chair. Oh, wow.
Mine too. So.
Anybody else want to rub that in? Palmer, if I might continue. Palmer, once again, thank you very much for your time on this, and you're very patient with this. I have to apologize to Representative Kenny Geyer. I'd like to tell you this is the last time you're going to sit through one of these, but this is the issue that just keeps on giving. So you're going to hear more about this. I'm sorry that they. Paint care folks in industry aren't here, and I think we're going to have to revisit that, obviously, because of the issues and the recommendations, but also because I'd like to have the committee hear from them, and it's too bad they aren't here today. So let's keep after this. I've got some issues that I won't bring up today about the recommendations, but I'm happy to see that you're working in that regard nonetheless. And lastly, I would just say, and you're probably glad that I said lastly, in regard to Representative Bent's and Representative Thompson's comments, these things take time to get going. And, you know, the silly bottle bill, so it didn't happen overnight. But I know for a fact, having recently traveled with Representative Bent's on numerous flights in China and elsewhere, he never listens to the safety instructions at the beginning. And I'm not trying to say he's not telling the truth or anything like that, but I doubt if he would really know if they told him about this or not. I'm just saying that. And, you know, he's here. He can defend himself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, if I may, Co-Chair Bailey and Co-Chair Gilliam, I do have to share this joke with you that we sometimes say around DEQ. There's only one letter difference between pain and paint. So we sometimes joke about that. And maybe you feel our pain, you know. So, but thank you. Thank you for your kind words.
And Representative, I suppose if we're going to get into bottle bill analogies, we might as well broach the question of where the leftover sheet is going.
Tracking that, so. Oh, look at the time.
yes, Representative Kenny Geyer, you will also learn to chuckle at the word a sheet at some point. So thank you very much for your time. And with that, we will close the informational hearing on Oregon's paint product stewardship law. I don't know why I have such a hard time saying that. And if there is nothing further from the committee, we will adjourn the interim House Committee on Environment, Water, and Energy.